This is traditionally, if not the quietest day in sports, one of the quietest days in sports, the day after the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. It's Bob McCown's John Shannon with you. You know, in the midst of this COVID thing, you can't necessarily say that things that are normally happen on a particular day actually will happen on that particular day because the schedules are all kind of out of whack. But
right.
Today feels pretty quiet, Shannon.
Other than NBA Finals Game 4 in Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee came off the mat on Game 3, which was a bit of a surprise to me. But home court advantage in the NBA has always meant something. So that's the only other event really today. It's funny because for years and years and years, the NHL would put out its schedule on this day because it knew there was going to be a ton of attention to it because of the point.
Nothing else going on.
It was a good day to talk about the future.
Well, from basketball, one of the things that came up yesterday or the day before was the possibility of the Philadelphia 76ers shopping Ben Simmons and the spec that the Toronto Raptors could be an interested party. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of questions about Ben Simmons. I'm not sure that he's a guy I would target. How do you feel?
Well, I don't think he's a complete player. I think that's the big issue. You know, as strong as he is, allegedly, defensively, what's that shooting touch been like the last few years? I mean, Raptor fans saw it firsthand during the playoffs a couple of years back, and you know, being the number one pick does not necessarily make you going to be a home run as far as a player. The fact that after Doc Rivers has had a year with him, that there would be some thought to try to get rid of him, if that is the case, that to me is a telling situation. Because if Doc Rivers can't make you better, I'm not sure who can.
Well, I don't dispute that point. I wonder though whether it is a question of the Philadelphia 76ers, who have had essentially the same core for several years, looking at what they have and saying, well, we haven't gotten there yet with this group. Maybe we can't get there with this group.
And you know, from an ownership and a management perspective, the Sixers view themselves right on the edge of the scientific side of basketball, probably more analytics or as much analytics as any basketball franchise going right now. And, you know, they will have done the numbers financially, on court numbers. They will have done it and said, okay, we're just not good enough. We need to make changes. And here's the obvious choice of who has to go and who should stay.
What would you be prepared to give up? Were you, Webster or Ujiri?
Oh gosh.
Let me throw a couple things at you. They're talking about Siakam.
I would rather have Siakam than Ben Simmons.
I would too.
I would rather have Pascal Siakam than Ben Simmons. I think neither you and I are Ananobi fans. I would not mind seeing Ananobi.
Well, that'd be a deal that I'd consider. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, I'd like to know what the plans for the Raptors are, period. I mean, are they in a rebuild themselves? Do they think they're one player away? I'm not sure Ben Simmons is that one player away guy.
I'll go further than that, John. I'll tell you, I think that Simmons is absolutely not that guy.
Yeah.
Of the guys who are allegedly at that level of possibly being good enough to change a franchise based on reputation, based on history, based on where they were drafted, Simmons is at the bottom of that list. I have great reserve about what he is and what he will be. He is still young.
Yeah.
We can't forget that. But as a general rule, after 3 or 4 years in the NBA, you have a pretty good idea of what the player is capable of being.
Yeah, although in talking with Ray Ratto yesterday, he was glowing about Andrew Wiggins, and there was lots of people that thought Andrew Wiggins was a bust. And here he is in year 8, And you know, and Ratto mentioned for the Warriors how integral he has been and how important he is to keep. So you know, being patient with players like this is a difficult thing, particularly with the amount of money involved, Bob. That's the real issue. I mean, that becomes the crux of it all. Are the Sixers afraid of the next contract? What's going on that they think that they're not going to get through it with him and having to pay him? He's not going to take a pay cut. I guarantee you that in this day and age in the NBA. So can they afford him? You know, that to me is the biggest issue.
Well, there's some speculation too that what the 76ers really want is Damian Lillard. And I think we can all
doesn't everybody.
Well, I think we can all understand that, and that they have come to the conclusion or the belief that the way they get him is through a three-way.
Oh.
And maybe the Raptors fit in that category, but it seems to me that in that scenario, somehow the Raptors wind up with Ben Simmons, and that's the issue that I think Toronto fans have to address.
And my gut reaction to that is I'm not sure I should be helping any team in my division. I don't want to help another team in my division.
Well, I mean, by allowing them to get Lillard.
Yes. I am not sitting here. I mean, I'm still one of those old fashioned competitive guys that says, and I know the business has changed. And I know that particularly in the NBA, these things happen, but I'm still saying I don't want to face a team that I helped facilitate a better player for 4 times a year. I don't.
Well, one of the suggestions also is that Simmons stays at Philadelphia at the start of the year and they look to trade him during the season or at the trade deadline. I think that Philadelphia's, and this is not uncommon, I'm not being critical here, but I think that Simmons' highest market value is right now. And that mid-season, Philadelphia will get significantly less. I don't think his value is going to go up. And I say that because I think there are many, many, everybody should have questions, as we do, about Simmons' abilities right now. If he does have kind of a breakthrough year in the first few months of next season, the only thing that happens is that Philadelphia's asking price goes up.
Yeah.
And then you're giving up probably way too much. So do you think the Raptors are in the market to move Pascal Siakam and his $30 million contract?
I don't. I don't think it makes any sense. I think you have to have some cornerstones. I think, you know, they've obviously decided Freddie's one of those. Unless there's something that we're not aware of that happened in Tampa or over the season, and there's a lot more. And when you talk to the guys around the club, like Doug Smith, who have had arm's length contact with the organization because of COVID, is something happened in the bubble that has changed their mind on this guy? I wouldn't be getting rid of Pascal Siakam. I wouldn't.
Well, then you have to weigh the issue of, how much has it hurt? How much did it hurt the Toronto franchise to be playing in Tampa?
Well,
and I don't know how you quantify that. And you certainly can't quantify it if you're on the outside like we are and everybody else is.
Right. The one thing is that I do think as an organization, when you've asked the players, and I'm using the word loosely, sacrifice a season for 72 road games. You certainly learn who's committed to the program. I really do think that. I think that they probably understand that. Yeah, that's right. And they have a better sense of who wants to be a long-term Raptor and who doesn't.
We're going to discuss baseball. Last night, of course, was the Major League All-Star game. I don't watch this game on a regular basis, but I did watch last night, probably because of the many storylines that exist.
Well, the Major League Baseball Otani screwed something else last night too. They screwed up something that was great about the baseball, about the All-Star game last night for me. Uniforms.
Oh my God.
I mean, one of the great magical moments for me was to see, and you know, Colorado, that Denver is a National League team, to see all the white or the home jerseys of the National League teams on the field at the same time. That was magic. That's a magical moment. If whether you're six or 66, that's a magical moment. And now everybody looked like they wore pajamas.
Well, rather than get into it, you and I, let's get our friend Buck Martinez's opinion on what happened last night, the impact the Toronto Blue Jays had in the outcome, and those horrid uniforms as well. Buck Martinez joins us after these messages. And we return. It's McCowan. It's Shannon on the program for this. What day is it, Shannon? Wednesday?
All day.
I have to check every damn day.
Yep.
Buck Martinez joins us from his home office in Florida. Buck,
we gave Buck a day off, but we decided to use him anyway.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you. So Shannon went off in our opening to the program on the uniforms last night. You're shaking your head. Those were abysmal. What was the thought process there?
It makes no sense. Not at all. Let me tell you, what's the genesis of the All-Star Game is you want to see your team represented at the All-Star Game. And you do that by wearing your uniform at the All-Star Game.
Yes.
And it's as simple as that. I mean, what baseball has done for several different areas has been awful. I mean, I don't want to see Tom Verducci on the field interviewing a player before the start of the game. And he was standing on the field as Nolan Arenado was taking ground balls to start the game, interviewing him. I don't want to hear the players talk during the course of the game. Let them play their game. Let them enjoy it. I thought the one thing, and I know you saw a different broadcast than we did, and we had the Fox broadcast with Joe Buck and John Smoltz, but you know what? The last thing they talked about was the game. It was very disappointing. But the uniforms, John, I agree with you. They were awful.
Yeah, what I was lamenting, Buck, was as a child, and I grew up on the West Coast, and I loved the San Francisco Giants.
And
to see the Giants whites with the Dodger whites and the Cardinal whites and the Cubs,
it's an all-star game
on the same field.
Yeah,
that used to be magical.
And how about Willie Mays leading off every all-star game? I thought that was the coolest thing in the all-star game.
What
Willie Mays would lead off.
One quick story. I've told this to Bob many times, but we went as a family. Our Easter vacation, we always went somewhere. And one year we went in 1966, we went to San Francisco. We drove 1,000 miles to San Francisco for Easter vacation. And my dad went down and went to a convenience store and came back. He says, boys, I have two older brothers. He says, boys, I've got 4 tickets to the Giants Cubs, Giants home opener, Candlestick Park. I said, oh, and I'm not even 10 years old. And I said, oh, Dad, that's great. He says, yep, the seats are right behind second base. So, but the upside of that was there we were 8 feet from Willie Mays every inning.
Yeah.
And this is before Candlestick was enclosed, Buck.
Yeah.
It was still a horseshoe. And Juan Marichal pitched. Leo Durocher was the manager of the Cubs. Horace Stoneman was the manager of the Giants. It was electric. It was so much fun. I've never forgotten. It was the first Major League Baseball game we ever saw, and it was the San Francisco Giants that I've been a fan ever since.
Yeah, you know what? That's right in my wheelhouse, of course. I graduated from high school in 66. So, the Giants were everything. My first game was 1958.
Wow.
I saw them play at Seal Stadium.
The old stadium, yeah.
We walked on the field afterwards because the clubhouse and the exits were out in the outfield.
Right.
So I had – my cousin was a fireman in San Francisco, and we had front row seats in the bullpen down the left field line, right next to the Cardinals bullpen. Well, Mike McCormick started against Lindy McDaniel. McCormick, I believe, was 19. Lindy was 22. I was 10 years old at that game.
Yeah.
And in 1973 – I caught Lindy McDaniel with the Royals.
No kidding.
Wow.
Yeah. And Mike McCormick was my teammate in spring training with the Royals toward the end of his career. But the Giants, to me, are still, I get goosebumps talking about Willie Mays. I mean, he was the best player ever. I mean, I'm with all due respect to Trout and Heron and Maris and Mantle, Willie Mays was the best player.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
How Cepeda,
about
Cepeda was at first too, by the way.
Yeah. So I mean, Willie McCovey, Cepeda, Cal Lanier, Jose Pagan, Chuck Hiller, Gaylord Perry, Bob Boland, Juan Marichal. Johnny Antonelli was there early on. I mean, there was just so many great names, and that's my team. That's the team I grew up with.
Well, I have no affiliation particularly with the San Francisco Giants, but I will tell you this. People of our vintage know this, that there was a time where you got one baseball game a week nationally televised.
That's right.
Yeah.
Saturday or Sunday, but usually on a Saturday afternoon. And every once in a while, you'd get to see a West Coast game. Not regularly, but
not very often. Yeah.
And my first real recollection of watching a Major League Baseball game, and I have no concept of whether it was or it wasn't, happened to be Sandy Koufax versus Juan Marichal.
Oh, I see.
Wow.
How do you beat that?
And I don't know how you beat that.
No.
I mean, here we are, how many 50 years later, and I still have that recollection in my mind, a black and white screen, that little black and white television set, and watching Koufax and Marichal. And it wasn't even a good picture. You know,
I'm not going to beat this to death, but the magic of where I grew up was that on a good overcast day with the clouds low on the mountains at home, you could get KGO. You could get Giants radio.
Yeah.
And listen to the Giants on radio 1,000 miles away. That was
Don Simmons and Russ Hodges.
Absolutely. That was fantastic. I mean, it was just.
Would you guys like a room or something?
Bye, baby. And you can kiss that one goodbye. And bye, baby. Those were the home run calls of those two guys.
Actually, while we're on this topic, because we don't want to be too negative about Major League Baseball all day, because if we talk about the All-Star game, we might. But who are your influences as a broadcaster then? Who do you, when you go into the booth, when you call a game, who do you hear? When you say things, who do you hear saying, I sound like the guy I liked?
Bob Uecker.
Really?
Yeah. And that's where, get up, get out of here, gone. That's Uecker's call. And yeah. I've kind of taken it naturally without thinking about it. But Uecker was my broadcaster when I played in Milwaukee. And in those days, we used to regularly carry a radio down to the bullpen, and that's where I spent most of my time, Bob, as you know. I was down at the bullpen. So we took a radio to the bullpen, and we would listen to Uke. And if you listen to his call still today, what's he, 83, 84 years old, he's talking about, get up, get out of here, gone. And that's his home run call. And, I've kind of taken it from that. But, Russ Hodges and Lon Simmons, and of course, I got to see Lon Simmons when he was doing the A's games later on in his life. And they were the guys I listened to when I was walking down my gravel road in Sacramento, California, throwing rocks up in the air and hitting with my baseball bat.
Mm-hmm. Well, there will be those in our audience that are not familiar with Bob Uecker the way we are. And yet for many of us, you didn't get a chance to hear a lot of Uecker. You got to see him on the Johnny Carson show.
You got to see him in
movies.
Miller Lite commercials.
Yes, exactly. And you think of Uecker as being maybe the funniest guy ever in a baseball broadcast booth. And he really was more of a comedian than anything else. But he was a really good play-by-play guy too, Buck.
He's a wonderful play-by-play guy, and he captures everything. But at the same time, he brings his personality into the broadcast. And he's a Milwaukee guy. He grew up in Milwaukee. He played for the Cardinals. He played in the World Series with Doc Taylor. He was on that same team with the Cardinals with Ron Taylor. And it's just an incredible career he's had. And he doesn't travel much anymore. I've seen him from time to time over the last several years, but yeah, he's a terrific broadcaster because he's right there with Ernie Harwell and Vin Scully as far as painting the picture of what he's watching. And it's incredible.
That way, you just reminded me of something, that there was almost a time where every team, had somebody that you identified with that wasn't a player.
Oh, Uecker, absolutely.
Harry Carey.
Jack Buck,
Harry Carey,
Bill Allen.
Well, yeah. and Vin of all those. Yeah.
I mean, they just go around and
they insulated they insulated the fan, they insulated the ball club from bad baseball at times. Well, yeah. The team's not playing well, but boy, I like to listen to Vin.
Yeah, you know, and Harry Carey and Ernie Harwell and those guys. And Tom Cheek. Cheek, certainly in that crowd as well.
Good point.
All right, we want to talk a little bit about last night's game and what we saw and what happens in the second half. Let's take a quick break and come back with Buck Martinez. More after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon, it's Buck Martinez on this morning after the quietest day in sports, morning after the All-Star game. So probably couldn't get a better performance by the four Blue Jays that were on the field. Couple of hits, couple of RBIs, Vladdy's ungodly shot to left field, and then winning the MVP. This is all great. And America got its first look, in many cases, at what the Blue Jays have. But if you're a Blue Jay fan, what does all that mean, Buck?
It means that the Blue Jays are in the middle of the baseball world right now. And they are the center and becoming quickly the center of the baseball world, much as they did in 84. Then 85, and then 89, 90, 91, 92, 93. And that, I think, is what is coming. Because you have the core, much like Bell, Barfield, and Mosby, Fernandez, and Garcia. Now you have the core of Guerrero, Bichette, hopefully Marcus Semien, Teoscar Hernandez will be here, hopefully for the long haul. But you have this core of homegrown foundation players, not necessarily all homegrown, but foundational players, certainly with Bichette and Guerrero. Then now you complement those by bringing in Ryu, by bringing in Springer, by bringing in a third baseman, by bringing in another starting pitcher, by bringing in a Craig Kimbrell, by bringing in that type of thing. The same thing that Gillick did in the 80s and 90s and leading up through that World Series season. I mean, when you think back to the players that they had a homegrown core. And then here comes Molitor, Stewart, Winfield, Henderson, Cone. I mean, it was ridiculous. But the one thing I think that is sad for me, and it's unfortunate for the Blue Jays, is that this particular team hasn't been able to play at Rogers Center with a packed house of Blue Jay fans, because that is another selling point to the potential free agents of Robbie Ray, Steven Matz, Marcus Semien. All those potential free agents haven't lived what we have seen through 93, 92, 93, 15, and 16. They haven't seen that as a home player. So I think that's really, really disappointing. And I think that's a tremendous selling point to keep those guys playing with the Blue Jays at the end of this season when they become free agents.
Well, and we are now hearing conversation. I don't know how much you have been able to assimilate this in Florida. I assume some. That there is a real chance, it appears, that by July 30th, the Blue Jays will get permission to play at the Rogers Center. Tell me what you hear.
I have been involved with the Players Association, and I've been in touch with them. And July 30th is one of the dates, and I think August 20th is the second date. And, you know, July 30th is very aggressive. It's, I mean, there's a lot of things that have to happen. Not only the legal aspects of it, but the physical aspects of moving from Buffalo to Toronto by July 29th or whatever it is, July 30th. But, you know, moving that whole production with the players, the families, the equipment, the trainers, and all of that stuff, that might not be doable by the end of the month. I mean, here we are on the 14th of July, and we're talking about 2 weeks. And it's going to take a lot more than 2 weeks, I think, to move the whole operation back to Rogers Center. Not only that, but you've got to clean up the Rogers Center. The Rogers Center hasn't had attention on the field. The Rogers Center hasn't been in service for 2 years now. So that's going to take a process as well. And I'm sure that they're starting to do some of that work, but they're not going to do all of that work until they get the full go-ahead.
And to your point, when they do go to Rogers Center the first few times, I don't think there's going to be 50,000 people in the place.
No,
no chance. Sure.
No. And it's going to be a while before the fans get comfortable with it. I mean, you saw what Colorado was for the last 2 days. I mean, obviously it was a packed house and everybody was there and it looked like a normal all-star atmosphere, which is terrific. And now I think we have to get beyond that. And, you know, it's for brighter people than us to make that decision. But at the same time, I think it's an important decision. And certainly, if the Blue Jays are going to be in a pennant race and have the potential of playing in October, you want them at Rogers Center.
In your discussions with the Players Association, Buck, does the discussion of how many players are vaccinated come up?
Yeah, but nobody's going to tell you that. I mean, they're not going to say how many. I mean, it's a privacy thing. And that's what gets me. I mean, people are just so anxious. Oh, yeah, it's privacy. I mean, your medical history is very private. And I don't think anybody should be under the gun to say, oh, yeah, I have, I'm not. But, you know, I mean, people are going to do whatever they want to do as far as the official statements and what the city, government, provincial, federal are going to require. But I don't think the Players Association will ever agree to acknowledging who has and who hasn't. I just don't think that's an issue that they want to get into.
Under normal circumstances, the players would have accommodations set up for themselves, either personally or through the team, condos, wherever they want to live. The odd player would stay at the hotel, but probably not for a long period of time. Having a hotel attached to the ballpark, given the COVID situation and that there will be players who have to isolate, is there any advantage in having that hotel there? I would assume most of the Blue Jay players at this point in the year would stay at the hotel, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I believe so. And here's another thing that you have that's an issue in all of this is the Blue Jays were in Florida basically around Valentine's Day, February 14th. They stayed there until the end of May. Then they moved to Buffalo. So now the families have gone from Florida to Buffalo, and now you're going to have a move again. I mean, that's a challenging thing. And now, too, from the visiting team's perspective, these visiting teams have traveled freely and been outdoors and going to restaurants and acting normally, and then you're going to ask them to stay inside a bubble situation in Toronto. I don't know how quick they're going to accept that. That's another question, too, because if they go to Buffalo, obviously everything is pretty normal, except for the ballpark and the size of the ballpark and everything else. So it's going to be an interesting topic among players and Players Association, but I know that they're negotiating of several aspects of it, the moving expense, the quarantine, what are the families required to do, how often are the families tested, can the families come, where do you stay, all of those things. There's a lot more to it than just saying, okay, the border's open, come on up. That's for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about the performance on the field. Before this game began, the focus of attention was, well, on three guys, but really on Ohtani and for justifiable reasons.
Right.
And then Tatis and Guerrero got kind of second billing as, you know, significant, great young players. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that Guerrero kind of stole the show.
No. And you know what, going back to 19 at the Home Run Derby, I mean, he's built for this kind of stuff. And this is his whole life. I mean, when you looked at his glove, I don't know if you, did you see the picture of his glove?
No.
At the All-Star game? He's got the iconic picture of he and his father when he was about 7 or 8. Mm. And it's all over his glove. He had it put on a glove for the All-Star game. It's incredible. And this is what he was born to do. He's a star. I mean, when his father was a great player, he was right there by his side. He was around all of those great teams. And when you think back to his path, when he first came up, he had four press conferences when he first came up. He had one in Toronto, one in Texas, one in Anaheim. Wherever he went, they had a press conference. He was 19 years old. I mean, how in the world was he going to handle that? And now, He has turned around more dramatically than any player I've ever seen in a matter of 1 year, as far as maturity,
don't
professionalism,
disagree.
And the way he goes.
And performance.
Performance. I mean, it all starts with the maturity. And he says, I looked in the mirror. I said, I've had enough. I'm not going to be fat anymore. I'm going to work out. And I hope that he understands where he went to where he is now. There's still another layer there. If he continues to address his off-season program. I mean, if he loses another 10 or 15 pounds, there's no telling what he can do.
Oh, yeah. Well, and not just loses it, but puts on muscle mass instead.
Exactly.
Of,
and he's 22.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
He's, you know, I mean, you talk about Mays and Mantle and Maris and all those guys when they were 28, 29, 30. That's when they really did their damage.
Beck, was there a watershed moment for him that turned this corner? I mean, you talk about the maturity. Was there something that happened after getting beaten by Tampa in the playoffs last season?
John, that's a tremendous point, because you remember, I think a lot of Blue Jay fans and real Blue Jay fans remember the image of Laddie and hanging his chin on the rail in Tropicana Field, watching the Rays walk them off. I mean, that was a moment. And I think, too, the fact that he and Bo and Cavan came through the organization together, I think they feel a responsibility to one another. They won in the minor leagues, and they got the taste of what it means to share a winning moment with your friends, with your best friends. And that is invaluable. And so I think there was a responsibility. And remember, Vladdy apologized to his teammates, which is unheard of. I'm sorry. I was out of shape. I let you guys down. I'm not going to do it again. So that's a powerful moment when you stand up in front of your teammates and take responsibility. And he did that. In Kansas City early on, we were all kids with the Royals in the 70s. George Brett, myself, Hal McCray, Frank White, Fred, everybody were kids. And we had that same feeling of responsibility. We had to win and do everything we could for our teammates. And I think Vladdy had that moment when he realized that he wasn't prepared for a major league season. And now you're seeing what he's capable of doing.
We are all impatient as human beings, fans more than, you know, the three of us who talk about this stuff every day. Should there be a level of patience on the part of this organization? Are they, we know they're good. We know the future is bright, but we all tend to want the future to be now. And as a result, there will be plenty of conversation. Already has been plenty of conversation about what the Blue Jays should do.
Right.
In the second half or at the before the trade deadline to try and get in the playoffs. Is that the wrong approach?
Bob, this is why you're so good at this. You know, that's exactly the right approach. It's, you know, fans are impatient. Media's impatient. You know, there's a lot of people that are impatient. They want things to happen now. But the front office and the manager and the coaches have to be patient. Because if you're not patient, you're going to make mistakes.
Correct.
Because Bo Bichette has barely played a full season worth of games. And everybody, remember back in April and May, move Bo to second and make Marcus a shortstop, and then let's just go with that. You have to allow people. I mean, if they'd have done that with Derek Jeter, he wouldn't have been in the Hall of Fame. And Ozzie Smith was the same way. You have to be patient as a manager, and that's why I think Charlie Montoyo is the best manager for this particular ball club, because he's got kids, and he's had kids for 18 years in the minors, and he had to be patient with those kids. When you have good talent, you have to recognize talent and allow it to develop. It's like you and your wine, you know? If you don't allow your wine to develop, you're going to drink it too soon, and you're not going to be impressed. You have to let it develop, and I think that's the important thing of this organization. Everybody was quick to say, Vladdy can't play third base. Where are we going to put him? Well, now we play him at first base, and all of a sudden he looks like a Gold Glover.
Well, and now, I think he is. Yeah.
And now if Bo Bichette has another year under his belt, if the end of the year and Bo's starting to feel a little more comfortable at shortstop, what do you have? You have a 30-home run, 300 hitter at shortstop, which allows you to have less production at catcher, maybe less production in left field. You don't need to have that same production all over the field because you have unique production at shortstop. So you have to be patient with Bo. You have to be patient with Cavan. You have to be patient with the catchers. Everybody keeps talking about these catchers and how, oh, the Blue Jays are rich in catching. They've barely caught over a full season of games.
That's right.
And it's, you know, they got five catchers on the roster, but there's no experience. They haven't, you know, yeah, they went through a postseason last year, but that was 60-game season. That doesn't count. You have to get through 162 games and find out what it's like to play meaningful games in September at the end of a 162-game season where you can reach back and get a little bit extra, where you can pull the pitchers through a game when they don't have anything. And, you know, these catchers now, they're looking at their thing every time. They don't have the experience to think on the fly. And you have to be patient with the catchers too.
So actually, if all five are healthy in the organization and they came to you and said, who are you going to put behind the plate? Who are you putting behind the plate?
Gabriel Moreno.
Okay, why?
He is quick. He's athletic. He puts the bat on the ball. He hits the ball to all fields. The ball jumps off his bat, and he's got savvy. He has an inner clock that works well. To me, he's the best prospect. We haven't seen him play in the big leagues. I've seen him play in spring training games. Mm-hmm. But he stands out. He looks like Carlos Ruiz to me. He's a Venezuelan catcher. He's got good arms, good hands. He throws well. But he's a right-handed hitter, and the ball jumps off his bat. So if I were picking today and say, you know, this is what Gillick used to do all the time. He would go around the room to his coach and says, what's our lineup next year? What's our lineup in 5 years? What's our lineup in 10 years? And he would make everybody think about projection and who's going to be the next guy. You know, is Carlos Delgado going to be our shortstop or our catcher? Or is he going to be our first baseman? Those are the things that baseball people have to talk about. And they don't come on a computer sheet where you say, okay, this guy is this guy. You have to know what you're looking at. And that's what's missing in the game today.
Well, to
sorry
that
about
point.
That.
No, hey, looking, no, it's perfectly valid. I mean, and you know, I don't know how well John knew Gillick, but you and I knew him pretty well. And he was an extraordinary individual who would, I mean, he would haul me into his office and say, what do you think of this? And what do you think
exactly.
of that?
Exactly. And I mean, that's the value of being a great leader.
Of course.
You get perspective from everybody around that sees your team. You make judgments.
It's funny. When you talked about that, Buck, I go back to being around the hockey arena, and there are a few guys around the hockey arena so confident and secure in their thought process, big names, that they would always ask you questions. Doesn't matter whether you are the attendant or the usher or a guy in broadcasting, somebody would come and say, so what do you think of our goaltending? How do we make that better? You know, and whether it was Lou Lamoriello or Scotty Bowman or Ken Holland, all these guys are never afraid to get input.
No, because you might hear something that you never thought about.
Right.
You might hear a perspective and say, well, you know, I don't like the way that he closes his glove on a puck. I don't like the way that he steps out of the batter's box between pitches. I don't like the way he loses his focus. And, it, you know, maybe his GM says, gee, I never thought of that. And then you take it back to your baseball people and you initiate another discussion about something you never thought of.
Well, a couple of days off for this team and then back at it. And do you expect the Blue Jays to be active at the deadline? And if so, you'd have to think it's primarily going to be the bullpen they're going to focus on.
You know, Bob, and that's another thing. Everybody looks at that place first, and rightly so, because it's right there in front of you. And if it had they had the people they expected to have in their bullpen, that would have made a big difference.
Well, sure it would have, yeah.
I mean, you know, losing Phelps, losing Yates, losing Baruchy, all of those guys that went down, Merriweather, all of those guys, Hatch. I mean, there's five guys right there that you can think of quickly. If they would have been performing at the level they performed in past, Blue Jays would be fine, but they're not. So I think there's a couple of things. You could look at starting pitching because it all gets back to pitching. I don't care what kind of team you have, and defense. And their defense, particularly on the left side of the infield has committed more errors than anybody in baseball.
Yep.
And that's Bo and Cabin primarily. And Bo's getting better. A lot of those errors came early in the season. But, you know, if you're going to think about run prevention, Corey Dickerson's an interesting guy. He's a guy that makes contact. He doesn't have much power. He's coming back from a foot injury. He's going to be probably a week into August, maybe, by the time he comes back. But he's a good left-handed bat and a contact hitter. Not a great outfielder. He won a gold glove in the past, but he might be an improvement over Gurriel in left field. So, I mean, defense is a thing. If they could get somebody like a Craig Kimbrel, then, of course, you push everybody down and you become that much more effective.
Of course.
And then you have Baruchy coming back. Dolis, he had terrible finger injury that he didn't say anything about, and that's why he looked awful. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have any feeling in both of his first two fingers. And those, you know, I mean, you throw a splitter, these two fingers you don't have any feeling in. How are you going to throw it?
Yeah.
So, you know, there are a lot of things. I do think they're going to be active, Bob, to get back to your point. I do think they have built up their player pool down in the minor leagues, and I will not call it player capital because I hate that word. They're players. They built up their player pool in the minor leagues and they're attractive to a lot of teams. So I, you know, but again, you have to be patient. You can't mortgage the future. And everybody asks for Gabe Moreno and you go, no, that's off the table. Everybody asks for Otto Lopez and Aurelvis Martinez and those guys. Those guys are off the table. And Klopfenstein and Pearson to this point, you can't move those guys yet because you don't know what they are. So there are other players that are, you know, coming of age. Kevin Smith's a great example. I mean, he's finally come around in AAA where he's back to being a top prospect again. So those are the types of players I think move.
Yeah, the next couple of weeks will be most interesting to see what they do and how they do it. And do they demonstrate the patience that we believe they will have and should have through this year, even though there's temptation dangling right in front of them.
Exactly. But
Rob Manfred said yesterday that seven-inning doubleheaders are going to be probably gone next year, and we're not going to put the guy at second base to start the extra innings anymore. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I didn't mind the extra inning rule in the situation. I thought that was okay, and it changed the strategy a little bit. Seven-inning doubleheaders. I mean, how many doubleheaders do we have anyway? They don't happen that often, and I'm not concerned about that. I think you have to be able to manage it. The one thing I think they should get rid of is the three batter rule. I think that changes the game dramatically.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's helped speed up the game. I just think they're still pitching changes, and then a manager's hand tied because he's handcuffed because he can't make a move and can't counteract and can't utilize the depth of his bullpen the way they constructed it. So you can't go back and forth. And I think that rule probably changes the game as much as the slide rule at second and home, which I have never agreed with. So those are things I would get rid of.
We could go on forever and ever, but and we often do. Do you like the pitch clock idea?
No. I think players can handle that. I think players understand that. You know what? The reality of the length of games has a lot more to do with TV time than anything
else. Sure it does.
You're damn right it does.
That's all. I mean, you know, back in you're talking about watching the game of the week, and they had maybe a minute commercial and all
that's
that.
That's what they had.
Yeah, 1 minute, you're back.
A minute five because they had a 5 minute station identification.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a minute five. Time is.
And now it's three and a half minutes between half innings.
Yeah, especially postseason all-star games and all that stuff. It's like, what happened to the game? And, you know, and that's why, you know, Dizzy Dean and Pee Wee Reese, those guys were so entertaining because they had so much time to talk.
There you go. We're going to let you go. Enjoy the second half. We'll bug you somewhere down the road. Thanks, Buck, as always.
It's always a pleasure. I love talking baseball with you guys.
Buck Martinez, we'll come back with more after these messages. And we are back, Bob McCallum, John Shannon, and our thanks to Buck Martinez for joining us. We always enjoy the conversation.
He never gets fired up enough, though. I mean, he never does. Gets fired. You see him. When you started to talk about get into the sabermetrics, there was a little bit of an old school guy coming out there.
Well, and, you know, Buck is not particularly apologetic about his opinions. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't care if he's viewed as being old school. And that's what I like about him, because I kind of feel the same way. I mean, I have opinions on things and I don't like sabermetrics. And I'm not ashamed to say it. And there are a lot of things in sports that I don't understand and like the way that things are being conducted. But I'll tell you the one thing that I thought was interesting out of that conversation was Buck's opinion on what the Blue Jays should do.
Yeah.
In the second half. And I don't think I was surprised, but I was pleasantly intrigued that he suggested it's a longer process than the next 3 months.
Well, and Bob, you and I have touched on this, not just about the Blue Jays, but about the Raptors too, and to a lesser extent about the hockey teams. But when you're not generating the revenue at home, like you normally do, why waste a lot of these resources at a time when you can't put people in your building?
But I don't see it as a resource thing. I understand your position on that, John, but I think this is truly about baseball and about how ready these guys are.
Right.
Again, you are talking about two guys who are 22 years old, who, if they'd been drafted out of college, would be at best at double A.
Mm-hmm.
At best at Double A.
Yeah.
And now they're getting, they both have 1 year, well, a little more than 1 year for Vladdy of major league experience.
See, the other thing that Buck didn't mention, but I think is vital to this team is making sure that Simeon's here long term.
Oh my God.
Long term. And so that's going to be a huge challenge for Mark and Ross to make sure they can get him on the dotted line.
Well, we'll watch that with interest and discuss it in the future. Thank you, Mr. Shannon. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
For John Shannon, Bob McCallum, that's it for us. Have yourselves a swell day, and we'll see you tomorrow if the creek don't rise. Goodbye, everybody.